Welcome. We've now reached the point in our course when the entirety of the Greek-speaking world has come under Rome's rule. And it would remain under Roman rule until the division of the Roman Empire into two halves on the death of the Emperor Theodosius in AD 395. With the absorption of Egypt, the Hellenistic period officially comes to an end and the period of the Empire begins. On assuming undisputed power in 27 BC, Augustus made a minor administrative adjustment to mainland Greece by creating a separate province called Achaia, formally incorporated within the province of Macedonia. He also took personal control of Egypt due to its importance as a corn-producing region. The Greek-speaking world, like most parts of the empire, Judea is an exception, would henceforth remain at peace for over 200 years. And we've now reached a point where it's legitimate, even appropriate, to talk of Mediterranean man, in the sense that there are now millions of people living in the Mediterranean who have a shared outlook and vision, who to a large extent share similar goals, and who are subject to similar physical conditions, and who crucially live under the same form of government. How many millions? Bruce Fryer estimates that when Augustus died in AD 14, the total was, I quote, slightly more than 45 million persons, of whom about 20 million resided in the east and 25 million in the west. George Grote, in the preface to his 12-volume History of Greece, first published 1846 to 56, wrote, as a whole, the period between 300 BC and the absorption of Greece by the Romans is of no interest in itself and is only so far of value as it helps us to understand the preceding centuries. Well, that opinion is long since out of date. The Hellenistic period is today probably the most researched period of Greek history, thanks to the enormous wealth of papyrological and epigraphical data that it provides, writings on papyrus and inscriptions on stone and other materials that have survived in quantity in the hot sands of Egypt. But Grote was wrong for another reason that has important bearing on this course. The period between 300 BC and the absorption of Greece by the Romans is actually of incalculable value because it helps us to understand the following centuries. In particular, it helps us to understand the Principate, though Octavian, before he became Augustus, also drew inspiration from the preceding classical period. By the late 1st century BC, Roman society and culture had become profoundly influenced by Greek literature, art, architecture, religion, philosophy, science, medicine, and so on. This phenomenon, which we label Hellenism, wasn't just icing on the cake. It was something that was coursing through the cultural bloodstream of the Roman people. It's virtually impossible to extract its exact flavor from our sources, but it was endemic and pervasive. We've already looked at its impact on such topics as religion, forms of entertainment, sexuality and death, and in later lectures, we're going to explore its influence on other areas of Roman life. The Principate, which came into being in 27 BC, 4 years after the Battle of Actium, is so named because Augustus, as he now became, took the title Princeps. Princeps gives us our word prince, though it had no such connotations for a Roman. On the contrary, it was a rather vague term, best translated as first citizen or chief. It had previously been applied to the most senior member of the Senate. The Principate was unlike any other governmental system before or since. I suppose the best description of it is a disguised autocracy. Augustus left the republican framework intact. The voting units represented by the various comitii or assemblies, the Senate, the consuls and other elected magistrates, the provincial governors, etc., and he just placed himself on top of all that, so to speak. In his role as princeps, Augustus effectively took all the most important decisions affecting the Roman world. He also assumed a number of constitutional powers, even though the republican structure, which included annual elections, continued in place. He was first tribune of the people. Second, he served as consul for a number of years. Third, he governed a number of provinces. And fourth, he eventually became supreme pontiff, senior religious official of the Roman state. But his authority, his auctoritas, to use the Roman word which he virtually monopolized, emanated from his personality and from the veneration in which he was held by his devoted subjects. And they were devoted. Augustus enjoyed enormous popular support. He declares in the Res Gestae, the inscription that was promulgated after his death listing his achievements, that he achieved power per consensum universorum, by universal consent. Well, that's a slight exaggeration. It wasn't as if Mark Antony didn't have any supporters. And once he'd established himself in power, Augustus had to put down a number of conspiracies and plots against his life. Suetonius mentions at least half a dozen. But largely, his claim is correct. Our image of Augustus has been greatly influenced by Sir Ronald Syme, whose great work, The Roman Revolution, published in 1939, takes a rather hostile view of him. Syme writes, "The happy outcome of the Principate might be held to justify, or at least to palliate, the horrors of the Roman Revolution. Hence, the danger of an indulgent estimate of the person and acts of Augustus. The end, in other words, should not blind us to the means, and Augustus was very, very ruthless." The term Roman Revolution, by the way, should be viewed with caution. There was no bloody uprising and overthrow of the existing order, but a relatively peaceful transition. Well, leaving the person of Augustus aside, his acts were considerable. It was he who gave shape to the empire in an enduring manner. Yugoslavia, Austria, Hungary, and Bulgaria were all conquered in his reign. He tried to conquer Germany as far as the Elbe, to shorten the boundary marked by the Danube River, but one of his generals, Publius Quinctilius Varus, suffered a severe defeat in 9 AD at the hands of a German chieftain named Arminius in the Teutoburg Forest. In the east, Augustus wisely concluded that the empire should not extend further than the Euphrates. Despite the horrors of Caligula, Nero, and Domitian, the system that he established brought peace and security to millions of people for 200 years, excepting from time to time the turbulent province of Judea. And throughout that time, the emperors continued to expand Rome's control of the Mediterranean and, no less remarkable, maintained administrative control over it. And the horrors to which I alluded, the intrigues and the murders, were mainly limited to those closest to the emperor and only rarely had consequences outside his circle, as in the case of the persecution of Christians by Nero. Augustus, like every Roman aristocrat of his age, was deeply influenced by Greek culture. Suetonius tells us that when he was a young man, he had ambitions to become bilingual in Latin and Greek, though he never succeeded in achieving fluency in Greek. He studied under a Greek tutor called Apollodorus of Pergamum, so it's not altogether surprising that he had turned to Greece for his inspiration, as he pondered how to package his new constitutional system, even though there was no exact Greek precedent for it. And by package, I mean the ways in which he presented or commodified, to use a term borrowed from sociology, the Principate. First, he incorporated and developed the concept of ruler cult. Under the Republic, the only ruler that could be worshipped was the state itself, or rather, the community that comprised it. Though a few Roman generals had been deified by Greek states, this practice never spread to Rome. Mark Antony, for instance, was worshipped in the East, but never in Rome, as the god Dionysus incarnate. The first Roman to be accorded divine honours in Rome was Julius Caesar. Caesar did not, however, become Divus Iulius, the deified Iulius, until 2 years after his death. From the very beginning of his reign, Augustus understood the benefits of ruler cult. As early as 30 BC, the Senate decreed that wine should be poured to his genius, his genius, at drinking parties. And in 27 BC, when he took the title of Augustus, the Athenians lost no time in deifying him, eager to get into his good books from the word go. Augustus was extremely careful not to arouse any suspicion that he sought divine honours, though he was happy to play with the idea that he enjoyed a special relationship with the divine. At the same time, he was deeply aware of the cultural differences that existed between Greeks and Romans in respect to the worship of living men. So he permitted non-Romans in the East to build temples jointly to Roma, the personification of Rome, and to himself, Augustus. This was relatively uncontroversial because in the East, the worship of Augustus could be integrated into the existing religious framework. Roman citizens in the West, however, were only permitted to build temples to Roma exclusively and to the deified Julius. In the course of his reign, however, things slowly changed. Augustus found it convenient to condone centers of imperial cult in the western part of the empire, where there was no previous tradition. In 12 BC, for instance, an altar of Roma and Augustus was established at Lugdunum, Lyon, in southern France. Second, Augustus took over the image of the Hellenistic dynast as an enlightened and benevolent leader. We talked previously about the attributes of euergesia and philanthropia, beneficence, and philanthropy that Hellenistic dynasts sought to attach to their names in order to promote and polish their reputations. In the Res Gestae, Augustus enumerates his benefactions to the Roman people, the largesses that he regularly distributed, the numerous buildings he either restored or built from scratch, the many gladiatorial games he sponsored, and so forth. This was munificence on a scale that far exceeded anything that any Hellenistic dynast had done for his people, but it was nonetheless a manifestation of that same tradition. A third area in which Augustus borrowed from the Greeks was sculpture. Here, however, the inspiration was classical rather than Hellenistic. At the beginning of his career, the youthful Octavian appears in a less than imposing light, as on a bronze head from Meroe in the Sudan, in which he gazes at the viewer somewhat sorrowfully. However, once he takes the title Augustus, everything changes. From now on, he's depicted in the guise of a classical Greek hero with idealized features and a lofty expression. Now, this was very far from reality, by the way. He was below average height, had spots all over his body, suffered from decaying teeth, and was troubled by an occasional limp. The most famous surviving portrait is the Prima Porta, so named from its fine spot in Rome in the grounds of the villa of his wife Livia. It depicts a barefoot, slightly larger than life-size Augustus in the pose of a Greek hero wearing ceremonial battle dress. A baby Cupid riding on a dolphin is beside his right foot, reminding the viewer that Augustus claimed descent from Venus through his adoptive father, Julius Caesar. It's one of the finest works in the neoclassical tradition, the revival of the classical style that was favored by Augustus. The Prima Porta type, this statue is by no means the first example, is in fact a direct quotation, so to speak, of a famous statue known as the Doryphorus, or Spear Carrier, dated 440 BC by Polycletus, a sculptor from Argos in the Peloponnese. The only Roman bronze copy, once in Munich, was destroyed in 1944. The spear carrier was known as the cannon because it exhibited Polycletus' views about the ideal proportions of the human body. The Prima Porta not only reproduces those proportions, but it also replicates the contrapposto style of the spear carrier, tensed left arm and right leg, relaxed right arm and left leg. So, in taking over this artistic type, Augustus was placing himself inside the classical tradition as epitomized by physical perfection and passionless serenity. Incidentally, the image on the breastplate shows a relief of a defeated barbarian returning a legionary standard to a Roman commander, an allusion to the fact that in 20 BC, Augustus had secured the return of the standards taken from Marcus Licinius Crassus and Mark Antony by the Parthians at the Battle of Carrhae in southeast Turkey in 53 BC. It was one of the worst defeats ever suffered by the Romans. Augustus, however, is being economical with the truth. He actually achieved the return of the legionary standards by diplomatic means. In the minor arts, Augustus was even more vainglorious in having himself depicted as the lookalike of Zeus or his equivalent Jupiter. For instance, in a famous cameo in the British Museum, cut out of Sardonyx, he is depicted wearing the aegis, the breastplate of both Zeus and his daughter Athena, with the head of a gorgon in the centre and snakes around the edges. Fourth, Augustus used the language of Greek architecture to express the ideals of the Principat. In particular, he exploited Greek architectural forms for propagandist purposes. There are lots of Augustan buildings that demonstrate the influence of Greek architecture, but I'm just going to talk about a couple of them. First, his mausoleum. This was a colossal tomb erected in the Campus Martius, the Field of Mars, to contain Augustus's remains and those of the imperial family. It was planned very early in his reign. It may even have been planned before his victory over Cleopatra and Mark Antony at Actium. As we saw in our previous lecture on death, both funerary ritual and funerary monuments were exploited by the Greeks and Romans to enhance family prestige. Augustus's mausoleum was a spectacular instance of that tendency. It was over 80 metres in diameter and stood nearly 40 metres high. It was surmounted by a cylinder with a colossal bronze statue of Augustus on top, estimated by some scholars to have been over 7 metres in height. No Roman tomb had ever been built on this scale before, and it would remain unsurpassed throughout antiquity. Hadrian's tomb, built a century and a half later, known today as the Castel Sant'Angelo, would equal it, but tactfully not exceed it. The word mausoleum derives from the eponymous tomb of a ruler named Mausolus, who died in 353 BC. Mausolus was a fascinating cultural hybrid, being by birth a Carian, that's to say a non-Greek, who was deeply influenced by Greek culture and who also had political links with the Persians. Located at Halicarnassus, modern Bodrum, on the west coast of Turkey, his tomb became famous throughout the Mediterranean and was later regarded as one of the seven wonders of the world. Augustus's tomb was modelled both on the mausoleum and probably on the tomb of Alexander the Great in Alexandria, though no traces of that tomb have survived. And because he officially named it the mausoleum, he was announcing to the world that he was the number one man in Rome. It was a public relations gaffe, however, because it suggested that he was putting himself on a par with Greek monarchs. The Romans, lest we forget, were deeply suspicious of anyone who exhibited monarchical pretensions. Well, Augustus learnt his lesson early, and no other building demonstrates such offensive self-aggrandizing. The second building that I'm going to use as an example of Augustus's debt to Greek architecture was in a very different mode. It's the so-called Ara Parcis Augustae, the altar of Augustan peace, which was also erected in the Campus Martius and which commemorated Augustus's safe return from the western provinces after 3 years' absence in 13 BC. The altar was completed in 9 BC, and I'll talk about it in some detail in the next lecture. The single point I want to make here is that it represents a combination of classical and Hellenistic art in this case. The frieze that runs around the outside wall of the enclosure is clearly inspired by the frieze that runs around the Parthenon in Athens. However, the formal elements that decorate the enclosure wall, acanthus plants that send up symmetrically arranged scrolls terminating in rosettes, clusters of vine and so forth, with lizards, birds and other creatures poking through, are inspired by Hellenistic playfulness. Fifth, Augustus exploited the stirring image of the ultimate warrior hero, Alexander the Great. After the Battle of Actium, he founded a new city called Nicopolis, Victory City, on the site where he had pitched his camp. Now, it so happens that Nicopolis was the name that Alexander the Great gave to a new foundation which he built in 333 BC to commemorate his victory over the Persian king Darius at the Battle of the River Issus. And when Augustus visited Alexander's tomb in Alexandria soon after his victory, he paid homage to the great man by placing a garland on his mummified head and strewing his remains with flowers. On being asked if he wished to visit the tombs of the Ptolemies, Augustus replied, "I came to see a king, not a row of corpses," a memorable soundbite, if ever there was one. In another act of homage, Augustus exhibited two paintings of Alexander in the most prominent part of the new forum that he built in Rome. And he also reproduced Alexander's tousled hair in his own sculptural portraits, thereby eliding his image into that of the world's most successful general. Augustus wasn't the first Roman by any means to model himself on Alexander. Other prominent Romans had been equally inspired. Gnaeus Pompeius, Pompey as we call him, a generation earlier, had affected a similar hairstyle to Alexander. And the fact that he was hailed Magnus the Great by his troops is hardly likely to be coincidental either. There's also the story told by Plutarch of Julius Caesar groaning as he gazed upon a statue of Alexander the Great in the Temple of Hercules at Cadiz because of the poverty of his own achievements aged 30 compared with what Alexander had achieved at the same age. In other words, Alexander the Great had become the yardstick of military glory, and successive Roman emperors would also seek to model themselves upon him, irrespective of whether they were military-minded. Augustus himself was by no means a military genius, and he left the business of fighting battles to his henchman, Marcus Vipsanius Agrippa, though he claimed to be himself the guiding military genius. In the Res Gestae, he proudly lists all the victories that were won under his auspices, as he puts it, which is a sneaky way of saying, I won every victory that occurred in my reign, whether or not I happened to be present. The sixth and last major area where Augustus was heavily indebted to Hellenism was in literature, specifically poetry. All the major poets of the Augustan age, Horace, Propertius, Virgil, Tibullus, and Ovid, were profoundly influenced by Greek models of poetry. We're going to be looking at poetry later, but what I want to emphasize here is that it played an essential role in helping to articulate the aspirations of the Principate. I'm going to confine my remarks to Virgil and Horace because they're the most striking examples of this literary trend. I'll begin with Virgil. As I'll demonstrate later, the epic poem that Virgil wrote at the request of Augustus, the Aeneid, draws very heavily from both the Iliad and the Odyssey. What I want to point out here is that in so doing, it also offers the reader nothing less than a total re-evaluation of Roman identity in light of recent political events, and that is something very, very Augustan. Aeneas, the hero of the epic, for all his moral shortcomings, represents, through his pietas, his piety, the embodiment of Augustan man. The Aeneid is, in many ways, the charter myth of the foundation of the Augustan Principate. I don't mean to imply that Aeneas is a stand-in for Augustus, but the fact that Augustus claimed to have refounded Rome by restoring the Republic makes Virgil's meditation upon the cost of Rome's first foundation almost unbearably poignant. And it would have been even more poignant for Virgil's readers, still haunted by the memories of the recent civil war. Horace was a very different kind of poet altogether. He had a very different relationship with the Augustan Principate, but he too occasionally, though never perhaps wholeheartedly, put his poetic services at the disposal of the Principate. And Horace, like Virgil, was deeply influenced by Greek models. In a poem entitled the Ars Poetica, the Art of Poetry, he writes to any aspiring Latin poet, "You must take Greek examples in hand day and night." He also claims that he was the first Roman poet to introduce Greek meter into Latin verse, certain Greek meters. And that's not actually true, by the way. The epic poet Ennius was the first, but Horace did introduce a number of other Greek meters for the first time. He also quotes Greek poets in his own poetry, literally translating their lines into Latin. And he uses the symposium, the Greek drinking party, as a setting for many of his poems. Well, did Horace, like Virgil, celebrate the values of the Augustan age? Well, sort of, but it's difficult to take Horace's exact measure. He's an extremely complicated figure. The only poem he wrote that unequivocally celebrates Augustus's achievements is the Carmen Saeculare, the centennial hymn, which he wrote in 17 BC to commemorate the birth of a new saeculum, or age. "Now faith and peace and honour and respect and neglected virtue dare to return," he writes, "and blessed abundance with her cornucopia is among us." Elsewhere, however, Horace tactfully refuses to write an ode celebrating Augustus's return from abroad in 16 BC on the grounds that he lacks the skill of a Pindar, the Greek lyric poet most famed for his celebratory odes. Well, it's all just poetry. Who cares a damn about poetry? Actually, reading poetry was a favoured pastime of the educated elite in the Augustan age. So poetry had a significance and an influence that were far greater than is the case in our society. It goes without saying that the services of Horace and Virgil were hardly critical to the stability of the Principate. But the fact that men of such talent were prepared to make even mildly supportive references to the reign of Augustus was not without value for it. As Garrett Fagan has pointed out, we shouldn't infer that the poets were ordered to toe the party line, so to speak. It's interesting in this regard that Horace declined the position of private secretary to Augustus, but there may have been encouragement to do so. So here was another weapon in Augustus's propagandist arsenal that drew deeply from Greek models, even though the political agenda that it served was without Greek precedent. Lastly, Augustus was involved with Hellenism in more informal ways. Suetonius tells us that when he happened to be staying on Capri in the Gulf of Puteoli at the end of his life, he commanded that the Greeks should dress as Romans and talk Latin, and that the Romans should dress as Greeks and talk Greek. Like other educated men of his day, Augustus was evidently intrigued by the similarities and differences that existed between the two peoples. In fact, the party caper seems designed to extract innocent amusement from what had once perhaps been a tense and acrimonious relationship and which had now recently been transformed politically into something more neighbourly. But hang on a minute. There's a deep irony running through Augustus's dependency on Hellenism in that he always claimed to be restoring the Roman Republic and all the old Roman virtues. Romanitas was in fact one of the watchwords of the Principate. It just goes to show that Greek culture was so deeply embedded in the Roman way of thinking and of conceptualizing that its influence operated below the level of consciousness. To conclude, Augustus utilized Hellenism to promote the ideology of the Principate in a variety of ways through the construction of his public persona, in the way he cast his public acts, and through his harnessing of the media. The Augustan Principate represents a crucial turning point in our course, in that the entire Greek-speaking world was now incorporated into the Roman Empire as a vital and enduring factor in the composition of its devolving culture. It would be under this same administrative system that the culminating integration of Greece and Rome would take place before that system became increasingly autocratic in the 3rd century AD. In the course of the next 9 lectures, we're going to examine specific areas of Greek influence over an extensive period of time, while still remaining attentive to the pivotal moment of the Augustan Principate. And first, we'll see how Greek art infiltrated the Roman psyche so deeply that it often became indistinguishable from the art, which is sometimes categorized as Roman.